Welcome to the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Today is Friday, so that means we are starting with our news today. Here's your news brief. Ag officials from Nebraska and two other states have decided to invest more money into ethanol-based fuel markets in California. The Journal Star says the Nebraska Corn Board and corn checkoff groups in Missouri and Kansas will provide California with $1.25 million over the next 12 months to help increase the availability of gasoline with 85% ethanol blend, which is commercially known as E85. Pearson Fuels will supply the fuel. It is California's largest E85 distributor. Pearson has almost 250 retail locations around the state. This is Nebraska Corn Board's second investment in E85 in California. The domestic rail transportation network is vital to moving agricultural products and goods. Chad Smith has more on rising freight rail rates that are pressuring farm income.
The cost of shipping commodities on domestic rail systems is rising, and it's putting pressure on U.S. farmers and ranchers' bottom lines. Daniel Munch, associate economist with the American Farm Bureau Federation, says rail rates on agricultural goods have risen as much as 18%.
One of the main takeaways from our research was a clear increase in the cost of shipping agricultural commodities on domestic rail systems. Rail rates on corn have gone up 13%, on soy have gone up 11%, and on wheat 7% over the past 5 years. Similarly, rates to transport ethanol have increased 18%, or about 4 cents a gallon.
Much to his surprise, Munch said the rising cost of fuel wasn't a primary driver in the higher cost of shipping freight via railroad.
Adjusted for inflation, rail fuel costs have remained quite similar to 2018 and 2019 rates, unlike what consumers are experiencing at the pump. They have increased quite a bit in the past year, but mainly as a comeback from COVID-19 related demand shocks. Additionally, demand for freight rail, from the ag sector at least, has remained steady over the past 5 years, with a few spikes associated with increased exports. So overall, fuel and transportation demand were not clear pressures for increased rail rates.
Munch analyzed shipping rates by origin and destination states. In both cases, Munch said states east of the Mississippi River had the highest increases. Reduced competition in the rail market is also playing a role in the rising cost.
In the ag sector, we found that over the past 15 years, non-competitive rail movements or routes not subject to strong competition have increased from 20% of revenue to about 43% of revenue. When there's limited competitive forces, this can incentivize price-setting behavior and disproportionately impact rail customers, like farmers and ranchers, limited in their ability to choose other options to transport their goods.
Learn more at fb.org/market intel. Chad Smith, Washington.
The North American Meat Institute issued a statement on what it calls inflammatory statements from Brian Deese, director of the National Economic Council. During a press briefing, Deese said concentration in the meat sector raised concerns of pandemic profiteering. He and Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack released a report that says four large conglomerates overwhelmingly control meat supply chains, driving down farmer earnings and driving up consumer prices. Mark Dopp, the COO of the North American Meat Institute, says, as with almost every industry, meat and poultry packers and processors of all sizes have been and continue to be affected by the global pandemic and the inflationary trends that challenge the U.S. economy. American consumers of most goods and services are seeing higher costs, largely due to a persistent and widespread labor shortage. He says the meat and poultry industry is no different. Colleges and universities with ag research and extension programs not under the land-grant university designation recently received federal grants to continue their innovation and teaching efforts. Rod Bain reports.
Land-grant universities, the term associated with research and agricultural colleges and universities granted the designation through various acts of law in the year of passage, 1862. 1890 and 1994. But then what constitutes an institution of higher education being called a non-land grant university?
The non-land grant colleges of agriculture are public colleges and universities that offer a baccalaureate or a higher degree in food and agricultural sciences. Some of these eligible colleges and universities must be public institutions not previously designated by the legislation as the land grants. They must grant either a bachelor's, master's, or doctoral degree in food, agriculture, or natural resources. And they must include a primary major in one of 22 areas defined in the 2018 Farm Bill.
USDA National Institute of Food and Agriculture Director Carrie Castile says with Share Food and Farm Research goals,
our land-grant universities are a partner, but also our non-land-grant universities and their colleges of agriculture are also a strong partnership.
Recently, NIFA made an over $7 million investment in non-land-grant colleges and universities of agriculture through various research grants.
We have 24 projects that we funded. Some of these research efforts are going to help improve our rural economies, increase food production, boost agricultural profitability and sustainability, address climate change, ensure food and nutrition security, and also train the next generation of the agricultural workforce.
The NIFA director offers examples from recent recipients of the variety of projects supported by these grants.
The American Indian Higher Education Consortium, which works in collaboration with the University of Wisconsin-Platteville, that's going to create a network of scientists and educators to facilitate research, education, and outreach activities related to soil and water quality. Another one is at Tarleton State University, which is going to help us learn how pollinator-friendly perennials and ornamental landscapes can provide a solution to decades of major declines in pollinators through their plant drought response and insect pollinator studies project. And then one at Humboldt State University in California that's going to use the grant to help prepare a diverse pool of natural resource scientists to enter a workforce focused on climate-ready and sustainable agricultural practices, particularly in the rangelands.
Castile adds that the continued partnership with both land-grant and non-land-grant colleges and universities of agriculture will be essential in advancing innovations and extension to address various challenges on a domestic and global scale. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
The National Pork Board is using checkoff dollars to partner with Emmy Award-winning actor Eric Stone Street to dispel common misconceptions about pig farming and redefine the phrases heard in common language. NPB's Senior Vice President of Communications, Jackie Mattson, says the producer-led Real Pork Barriers Task Force has been reviewing consumer perception data as it relates to food and purchasing behaviors.
Even though consumers say that they're somewhat or very confident in our product, we can't take that for granted. We have to make sure that we're continually asking them what's on their minds and what might be in the back of their mind, that if some issue or topic comes to bear, that they have enough confidence and we have enough trust built up that we can appropriately address it for consumers.
Mattson says consumers are most concerned about how animals are cared for, housed, and fed, and their beliefs are directly related to the protein they feed their families.
Those are some of the top issues the Barriers Task Force recognized were opportunities for us to address consumer questions and concerns. Let's start with those things around animal welfare, animal well-being, what animals eat, and how animals are housed and cared for, because we know those most directly relate to consumer confidence.
This myth-busting campaign addresses myths in an approachable and friendly manner through on-farm videos published on social media, a place where consumers are already browsing. Mattson says partnering with the former pig farmer, Stone Street, offers information without overwhelming consumers.
He has just the right tone where he can engage with consumers and share factual information, but do it in a way that's fun and lighthearted and doesn't feel overly academic and like he's lecturing consumers. So it's the perfect tone, the perfect spokesperson. And the concept of Rural Dictionary makes these myths really approachable for consumers.
You can go to pork.org to find out more. Americans are increasing their consumption of caffeine, but how much is too much? Gary Crawford has this report.
That's the sound of our single cup coffee brewing machine here at home, and in some households, it's getting a workout.
So hook me up to the machine. Microtop is coffee.
Well, that guy likes his coffee and the caffeine in it, I'm sure. And the average cup of coffee has a little over 100 milligrams of caffeine in it. The average coffee drinker in this country consumes about 3 cups a day. And according to the new government dietary guidelines, healthy adults can consume as much as 400 milligrams of caffeine a day, no adverse health effects. But that is for healthy adults with no underlying conditions like heart or blood pressure problems. And it's not just coffee, however, that's involved when it comes to caffeine.
Caffeine can show up in other foods, too.
Kansas State University Extension food scientist Karen Blakesley.
If you drink iced tea, lots of sodas have a lot of caffeine in them. Energy drinks have a lot of even more caffeine in them. So it's not just from coffee.
Very true. For example,
would you like to come over for tea?
Yes, teas vary widely, though, in caffeine content. 8 ounces of tea can have as little as 20 milligrams up to 120. And then, soft drinks. 20-ounce soda can have from 22 to 70 milligrams of caffeine. And then, of course, a relatively new arrival on the scene. The energy drink. Yes, those can range from, say, Red Bull 8-ounce can, 80 milligrams of caffeine, but then there's at least one 2-ounce drink with 230 milligrams of caffeine in it. Plus, we have currently on the market caffeine-enhanced water and then chocolates and such, so some of us may be unwittingly getting a lot more than the recommended daily limit of 400 milligrams of caffeine. Certainly, per-person caffeine consumption in this country has been growing. One estimate put it at a daily average intake, 1999 at 120 milligrams. By 2010, it was up to 165, 2018, 190, and today's estimates run from 210 to 238. But remember, this is the estimated average per person consumption. So Karen Blakesley says if you're curious about your own actual caffeine intake,
the International Food Information Council has what they call a caffeine calculator. It's on their website at foodinsight.org. It gives you some options to choose from to determine how much caffeine you're consuming.
There are places in there to type in how much and what type of coffee you drink each day.
Even decaf coffee, instant coffee, tea, different types of tea, sodas, energy drinks, and chocolate.
And again, that website is Food Insight, all one word, foodinsight.org. It has all things caffeine. Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
That's your news for today. We'll be right back.
The Crop Consultant Conference returns live in person on September 16th and 17th in Visalia, California. Co-hosted by Progressive Crop Consultant Magazine and the Western Region Certified Crop Advisors Association, this must-attend conference features 2 days of educational seminars, a live trade show, and honorariums and scholarships given by Western CCA, including the CCA of the Year Award. Hear the top experts in their field speak on pest management, artificial intelligence and new technologies, as well as the latest on soil health, nitrogen, and irrigation management. DPR and CCA credits will be available over the 2 days. For more information on credits, topics, and registration, visit progressivecrop.com/conference.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields. Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Welcome back. USDA is hosting a roundtable to provide examples of success stories of efforts to reduce food loss and waste, both inside and outside the country. In this week's Agriculture USA, Stephanie Ho focuses on some of those examples.
Why should anyone care about an issue like food loss and waste? Jean Busby, USDA's food loss and waste liaison, points to one important reason.
The average family of four spends $1,500 a year on uneaten food. So if they can find ways to reduce the amount of food waste in their households, that would save them money.
In order to provide inspiration and ideas to the public, USDA is hosting an online roundtable that will showcase food loss and waste success stories. The event is free and open to anyone.
I'm really excited about our event on September 15th, Exploring Food Waste Solutions, Success Stories from the U.S. and beyond.
I'm Stephanie Ho, and in this week's Agriculture USA, we'll take a look at some of the work from around the country that will be highlighted from California, Tennessee, and Vermont. For the San Diego Food System Alliance, encouraging residents to waste less food involved meeting them where they are digitally with Eco Challenge.
It really was a fun online social competition that engaged residents and households in these competitive food waste tracking challenges.
Sarah Fateh manages the Alliance's Wasted Food Prevention Program.
Participants actually were asked to weigh and record their food waste over a period of 15 months. And then during that time, we were also deploying some specific consumer education materials to provide them with those really tangible strategies for how they could reduce that food waste at home.
So participants interacted with the pilot program like it was a game, but the exercise also helped the Alliance answer its own questions.
If we have individuals or households engaged in weighing and recording their food waste over this period of time, and if we're also providing them with these really specific strategies and education for how they can reduce that food waste, could we see a specific and measurable reduction in household level food waste just as a result of those activities?
And what did they find?
For those participants that engaged in the food waste tracking for the 15-month period, we saw an average 38% reduction in household level food waste among those participants.
Meanwhile, starting last year, the state of Vermont completely banned food scraps from landfills.
Food waste is 20% of what we throw away. And that is very similar data, by the way, to the EPA, who tracks disposal in the U.S. The United States data also shows about 20% of the U.S. waste stream is food waste, and it's the single largest component by weight in the U.S. waste stream, as well as in Vermont.
Josh Kelly with Vermont's Department of Environmental Conservation says the ban had several goals: to reduce food waste
and to separate the scraps, really, and send those for better uses, whether that's composting or anaerobic digestion or animal feed, which we have in our state and many states across the country already.
Another goal was to encourage more private efforts, too.
Several new composters have sprung up as a result of the law going into effect. I can think of three or four, actually. We have a new anaerobic digester, the largest I've heard in the Northeast, that is now in Vermont and is a co-digestion of manure and food waste. And where we had about a dozen food scrap haulers before the law passed, we now have 45 or more. So we're more than tripled the number of service providers. A lot of those have growth in the residential sector, which is where we had the least amount of services previously.
Another example that USDA will be highlighting at its roundtable is the work of Urban Green Lab in Nashville, Tennessee.
Our mission is to teach communities how to live sustainably. So we believe that learning about sustainable living should be just a part of everyday life. And so the way that we try to do that is to organize teams of people in community institutions. We train them how to teach others, their colleagues or their families back at home, how to live sustainably. And then we connect them to resources that make a meaningful difference.
Todd Lawrence is the executive director of the lab, which works with the Natural Resources Defense Council, the Environmental Law Institute, and the city government on the Nashville Food Waste Initiative.
And I think people are just realizing that this makes a lot of sense. We eat food every day. We need to stop wasting it. And we've just found an overwhelming amount of support for this type of work here, which is, you know, maybe unexpected, especially in a southern city.
He points to one program where his group works with local chefs like Deb Paquette.
One of the things that she does in her restaurants is she takes the shells of shrimp, the shrimp shells, and dehydrates those shells and turns them into basically dust powder, which she uses in dressings and all kinds of other seafood-related dishes to kind of give them a hint of the sea.
For more information and to register for USDA's September 15th roundtable, go to usda.gov/foodlossandwaste, one word.
If you go to our main landing page, it's at the top of the page, right under the picture of the tomato.
This has been Agriculture USA. I'm Stephanie Ho for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
Coming up next, we highlight the week's top interviews. We'll be right back.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
Hi, welcome to My Ag Life. Today, we're talking with Brian Walbrink, co-owner of Sperry Farms Incorporated and chairman of Almond Board of California, about making the transition to off-ground almond harvest. Welcome, Brian.
Thanks. Thanks for having me. Really appreciate the time.
Yeah, great to have you here today. Brian, my first question for you here, off-ground harvest is part of Almond Board of California's 2025 air quality goals. Why is the Almond Board interested in the feasibility of off-ground harvesting?
You know, I think it's always good to look at where we're going in the industry. Although off-ground is not here today, and it's also not for everybody, it's really interesting to see the possibilities of off-ground. And I think that's what got the Almond Board very excited about looking at this as part of the harvest work group. So it's a look forward, it's futuristic, and we're very excited to be talking about it.
What is some of the research currently being looked at by the harvest work group, Brian?
We've had kind of an evolution of research with this work group. We really started with the feasibility on the ground, the measurement of dust. So we kind of got those things out of the way. We looked at the equipment. Now we're really on to the drying. We're really focused on the drying. Do we dry them in field? Do we dry them out of the field? I think that's the current snapshot of where the group's at today.
Brian, I just want to get your opinion on something. You know, as far as the work that the Almond Board has done with this research up to this point, do you foresee those 2025 air quality goals being met on time?
You know, I think we're in a good direction right now. You know, we have a few years left, but there's already been enormous progress. And I think just the industry talking about this as a whole is already a big win. We've already seen a dramatic dust reduction just from the equipment and from some of the evolution from the manufacturers. And I think this is such an important topic to have as farmers that we've already seen some huge gains in the first few years.
Being a chairman of the Almond Board now, what is the Almond Board, you know, planning on doing in the future to kind of get more of this off-ground harvest information out there to growers?
I think the Almond Board's role is really to be, you know, the discussion point and to bring groups that are interested in this concept forward, bring them together and kind of in this idea sharing collaboration way. We've had great participation from all the major manufacturers of almond equipment in this work group, but I think just getting the minds together and really having the discussion. This is our big event of the year. It's a one-shot deal. You know, it's 2 months, you know, very intense, very hot, very laborious for the growers, and really just notes and seeing what other people are doing, what's working, what's not working. And I feel like in farming, it's always easy to identify what's not working sometimes as it is to figure out what is working.
My next question for you here, off-ground harvesting has worked successfully in other nut crops and in almonds in other countries. Why is off-ground harvesting so complicated for California almond growers?
I think the size of us, I was fortunate enough to take a trip to Israel, and they're 90% off ground in the whole country, but you know, they're 15 to 20,000 acres. We're well over 1 million acres here in California. It was very interesting to see how their industry has wrapped their hands around around off ground. But the number one point in the orchard is the tree height. So when you get to the kind of the limbs of the tree, you have to have almost 3 feet in there. Most of the California orchards are anywhere from 18 to 24 inches. So actually getting all of that equipment underneath the canopy is a feasibility issue. So I think you really have to start kind of planning this from the orchard side when you're putting the orchard in. And it's kind of this, you know, back and forth, push pull, where the industry's at, you know, if I'm ready to make the dedicated plant for off-ground harvesting. So there's a lot of different variables, but I think that's the number one factor.
Do you, you know, maybe foresee in the future, you know, you say that Israel, you know, they got like 90% of the acres doing off-ground harvest. Do you foresee the California almond industry getting to that point, or maybe it even becoming a requirement to do off-ground harvesting at one point?
I think it's a case-by-case basis. You know, we supply 85% of the world's almonds here over the course of California. So it's a very, you know, geographically concentrated area, but we're dealing with a lot of different factors. So behind me is one of our ranches we're actually harvesting in this moment, which is really funny for the timing. But you know, we see a lot of foothills back here. So you have foothill harvest, you have flat harvest, you have big trees, small trees. So there's so many different variables. I think it's a case-by-case basis. It would be great if the industry could achieve maybe a 50% off ground in 10 years kind of thing. So it's a longer term, longer reach goal.
Brian, what really needs to happen before growers can begin making the transition to off-ground harvesting?
I think they have to have the confidence in the research. I think they have to see other success stories in off-ground harvesting, which is where the almond board comes in. You know, they're very good at highlighting successful stories if growers are willing to share their secrets. So it's such a huge cost investment, especially with the equipment you already have as a grower. I'm saying, I already have all of this harvesting equipment, so you're saying I can't use this anymore. So there's an equipment reach, but there's also that, you know, that futuristic planting. You know, an orchard is a 25 to 30 year investment. So if I'm gonna start planning towards off-ground harvest, I really have to make sure the tree's a little bit taller so we can get everything underneath it. So I think you just have to give the growers confidence that this is something that does work. It could be a great cost saver. And when you really think about it, you know, if your harvest was kind of a one-stop shop, you know, one machine came through, took the almonds out and out of the field, man, it's really nice because this is a crazy time of year for us.
I respect you saying that a lot of growers, you know, are worried about making that transition. Do you think there might be any sort of maybe incentive program in the future to kind of get more growers on par with off-ground harvest, like some of these other organizations do with maybe incentives for cover crops, that type of thing?
Yeah, there already has been some great incentives for almond growers up and down the state through air boards. And it's really focusing on dust reduction. It's focusing on harvester upgrades. So I think any sort of incentive package that could be attached to off-ground harvesting, where it's a cost split, you get a giant credit if you upgrade, kind of thing like our tractor programs through the air boards. Yeah, definitely. It'd be a huge help. The machines are very costly. And like I said, to make that big investment, you really have to have the confidence this is where you're going.
Brian, I want to circle back to something you mentioned earlier, that right now, a lot of the focus, at least for the board, is on mechanical drying. So mechanical drying versus allowing nuts to dry on the ground does raise questions again about cost and capacity. Brian, you know, are there any alternatives to mechanical drying being explored right now for off-ground harvest?
Absolutely. I think what's really important, which we've defined at the group level, off-ground harvest simply means the almonds are not coming in contact with the ground, which is very important because there is a approach that can be taken that some companies are working on. And it's a shake and catch and a redirect. And like they grow or dry other commodities, if there was a paper or a surface laid in the tree row and the almonds and the whole shells, kernels laid on top of that, you're still off-ground harvesting. So I think, you know, using our fields for drying, I think 100% is the best way to do it on a large scale. What Israel actually does, they will catch the almonds, take the almonds out of the field, and then take it to a drying location, and they'll put it back on the ground somewhere else. And looking at the feasibility, you can't really do that in California with the acreage size. So really, you got hot temperatures, you have nice airflow. So I think utilizing the middle of the tree rows, probably the biggest win for the industry.
Kind of utilizing those rows instead of, you know, mechanical, those energy cost savings are probably going to be fairly substantial, I imagine.
Yeah. And just the, I mean, and on the feasibility of that, right? I mean, there's only so many dryers in the state. And, you know, when you're looking, the kernel is anywhere from 20 to 30% of the total weight of the product. So really, like, looking at throwing all that into a dryer on a large scale, it doesn't seem to me, and it might to others, it might seem like that could be a good thing. But for me, to get widespread adoption, I think we got to use what God's given us out here. I think the heat, the sun, the air, I think if we can dry them out here, we're going to be way ahead.
Yeah, good sentiment. Brian, my last question for you here. Do you have any other thoughts for almond growers that are maybe looking to transition to off-ground harvest here in the future?
Get involved. Get involved with almond boards, show up to the meetings. Our meetings are open. Share secrets, hear from other people who are doing this. And it's kind of, you know, become part of the fun. You know, I think everybody's having a really good time being innovative when you can. And just join us on the journey.
Perfect. Well, Brian, thank you for being available today and coming out from the orchard to talk about off-ground harvest today. Really appreciate some of those sentiments there and some of the advice for that transition. We appreciate having you on today.
Yeah, thanks for the time. Appreciate it.
Perfect. This is Taylor with My Ag Life.
The California Walnut Board and Commission provides value to the California walnut industry by working together with growers and handlers to advance the industry. Together, the California Walnut Board and Commission are helping to protect, develop, and grow California walnuts domestically and internationally. The California Walnut Board provides funding and strategic direction on walnut production and post-harvest research designed to help support the industry and promote California walnuts. To learn more, visit our website at walnuts.org. Together we grow.
Don't let your soils become tainted and unproductive from excess salts. Take care of your crops while caring for your soil. Cation X5 Plus by AgroPlanté is a soil conditioner meant to maximize water penetration by combating harmful salts in the soil, which can injure your crops and bottom line. Cation X5 Plus also corrects sulfur and calcium plant deficiencies. AgroPlanté wants to help you grow your crop. Contact us today to find out more at 559-498-0388 or visit us at www.agroplanté.com.
AgroMayor Nursery is the premier nursery in California. Whether it's almonds, walnuts, pistachios, prunes, or olives, AgroMayor has been the grower's source for over 20 years and is the home of Rootpack R Almond, Grizzly Walnut, and the North American plants UCB1 and Platinum Clonal Pistachio Rootstocks. As the worldwide leader in super high-density almonds, olives, and prunes, AgroMayor can show you how to cut costs and increase yields with their super high-density rootstock Rootpack 20. For more information or to schedule a site visit, contact a representative at 530-812-3398 today.
As we continue previewing the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, we have for you one of the sponsors, SQM.
My name's John Allen. I'm the Western North America Sales Manager for SQM North America.
All right. Well, let's start out. Tell me a little bit about SQM.
So SQM is at our core. We're a Chilean-based mining company. Our headquarters exists in Santiago, Chile. And we have mining rights in the northern portion of Chile, in the Atacama Desert. The Atacama Desert's the driest desert in the world. We're a global company. We have offices throughout the world. And our products as well are shipped throughout the entire world, North America, Asia, Europe, Australia, and obviously South and Central America. SQM, I mean, so we have two different divisions, we'll call it for simplistic purposes. One is our industrial division. Our industrial division produces primarily lithium and iodine. I'm on the fertilizer side, SQM is basic in the three main potassium sources, potassium chloride, potassium sulfate, and potassium nitrate. We consider potassium nitrate our bread and butter, and it's really what we're out talking about the most. We also do water-soluble NPK blends and have multiple production facilities throughout the world, and we also have an organic line as well.
So in your position, you cover a very wide territory. Tell me about some of the things that you encounter. Are there certain issues that growers or PCAs are seeing and they come to you for solutions?
Yeah, so I do cover a large area, and we kind of dabble in most states. My territory is west of the Mississippi. So for example, in the Pacific Northwest, customers or potato growers in particular are looking for a product that's very, very soluble, which potassium nitrate is. In California, we see salinity issues, potassium nitrate has a relatively low salt index, and it could also be blended with a lot of different materials. I guess a benefit of potassium nitrate is the fact that it is 100% available to the plant, whereas there are other K sources that may not be 100% available. So really, I think what we've seen in the West recently is adaptation of potassium nitrate in all three grades, the crystalline form, the prilled form, and the liquid form. Dealers or growers are liking the versatility and some of the things that they can do to it compared to other potassium sources.
So at the upcoming Crop Consultant Conference, your company is one of the sponsors, and I believe you're sponsoring a speaking session.
We are.
What is that topic going to be on?
The topic is basically going to be a non-commercial presentation based on potassium nitrate and its benefits. And how potassium nitrate can fit in virtually any fertility program. It's the presentation itself is, I'd say, more on a little on the technical side, but it also puts potassium nitrate in practice as well. We're going to talk a little bit about utilizing liquid potassium nitrate. We're going to talk about briefly salt index, solubility, the three different grades, as well as the versatility of just potassium nitrate in general.
So it sounds like there will be a lot of information for people to learn through that session.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think, potassium nitrate's been used in western half of the United States for a while now, but it really has been in the shadows of other potassium products. And so my time with SQM has been basically educating growers and PCAs on the benefits of potassium nitrate. As again, I keep saying versatility, but we think the versatility portion of potassium nitrate is a great benefit. So really the presentations that we have created are based on educating folks, because a lot of growers, PCAs, aren't fully aware of potassium nitrate and its uses.
Will you also have a booth at the conference?
We will. We will. A large, hopefully an end cap booth. Yep.
All right. So what are some of the things that you're hoping to talk with people about at your booth?
Again, it really goes back to education. A lot of growers still aren't familiar with potassium nitrate. There will be several of us in the booth. Our global agronomist will actually be in the booth as well. And his job really is education. And in the booth itself, I mean, we'll get probably some very specific questions on utilizing potassium nitrate in liquid form. That's definitely a new application that hasn't really been around for very long. And so that is where a lot of our conversations tend to lead is using potassium nitrate in liquid form and injected in all crops across California.
The Crop Consultant Conference is September 16th and 17th at the Visalia Convention Center. For more information, you can go to myaglife.com and click on the link in the top left corner. That's our show for today. If there's a topic you'd like to discuss, send me an email to sabrina@myaglife.com. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Sabrina Halverson from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.